Welcome to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford. You know, we take an awful lot for granted here in the Triad. There are ballet and modern dance programs, musical performances of all kinds, exhibits, spoken word events, festivals, and so much more going on each week. It'd be absolutely impossible to attend them all. Well, you can thank the Arts Council of Winston-Salem and Forsyth County, first arts council in the nation, don't you know, for having too many choices. Leon Porter is here to explain. Then, speaking of firsts, how about the North Carolina Governor's School? Star students in at least 34 states enjoy this amazing educational opportunity today, but the very first Governor's School opened its doors right here in the Triad at Salem College 50 years ago this month. Today we pay tribute to one of the men behind this incredible milestone, Mr. John Ely. Director Lucy Milner, Professor Joseph Milner, and student Alex Kim will join me as well. Architectural Delights by Charles Barton Keane, The Sun Will Come Up with Annie Jr., and Peter Karoff gives us the best of Chopin next on Triad Arts Up Close. Imagine a Depression-era orphanage with not one but two mean old caretakers, twins as a matter of fact, glaring at you every day and forcing you to eat your gruel. Add an all-female cast, minus one, and loads of great music, and you get the first-in-flight entertainment production of Annie Jr. There'll be three performances only, August 3rd at 7 and August 4th at 2 and 7 at the Southwest Elementary Auditorium, 1631 Southwest School Road in Clements. You'll find links to more information on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. First in flight actors Mary Sparr, who plays Lily St. Regis, Nicole Horton, who plays Kate, Celine Yelsin-Kaya, who plays Grace Farrell, and Sarah Rosenberg, who plays Annie, drop by to talk about the play, show business, and more. They were joined by director and first in flight CEO of Fun, Aaron Diaz. So, Mary, you are Lily St. Regis. And for me, the most kind of more interesting character in the play. Tell me about Lily.
You're going to see this blonde chick who does have some space between her head. I think probably usually once in a while she'll have a good idea and it'll wow everybody.
Maybe she holds the key, that little lady, to get more bucks.
Instead of less, maybe we fix the game with something shady.
Where does that put us?
Give you one guess.
In one version of Easy Street I've seen, she is just looking at Rooster and Miss Hannigan like, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? I don't know what you're talking about. She's very much in her own little world, and I think she's a gold digger. I think she wants Rooster because he has potential, and she knows what she wants, and she's going to get that.
I think we all know somebody like Lily in our lives. Is there an aspect about her character that you found maybe tougher to pull off than others?
She has this Jersey accent that I'm still working on, so.
That's a whole other ball of wax, isn't it? Joysy. I bet you do some
she's
vocal
coaching.
She's
from Jersey City.
Oh, that sounded pretty good. How do you coach that first in flight director Aaron Diaz here? Tell me about how do you bring out the Joysy in a Joysy girl?
Well, it's funny because not only do we have Lily St. Regis that has her Joysy accent, but we also have Grace Farrell that has her upscale accent as well. So we have a lot. And then we also have the kids who are doing a lot of accents in the show. And then we have our guys who are being played by women as well. So we have to make them manly as well. So there's a lot of rehearsing that goes on in that.
I'll bet. You didn't know you were going to be learning a foreign language and doing Annie, did you, when you came in here? And then 11-year-old actress, Nicole, you're playing the role of Kate. That's a tough orphanage. What's life like in there?
Well, life in there is pretty awful. We got the Hannigan twins, twice the trouble. We get hot mush every day, and sometimes we get cold mush.
What is mush? Any idea?
I have no idea what mush is.
It just sounds bad. I think it was like a cross between like slop and oatmeal or something like that, but nothing I want to eat.
Yes.
Yeah. Lynn, you're playing the role of Grace Farrell. Daddy Warbucks is his faithful secretary seems to see something in Annie that maybe escapes other people. What's the connection with you and Annie?
I feel like being Grace makes me kind of like her mother, because for a lot of the beginning of her time at the mansion, I was the one taking her places and stuff, and it's just really fun.
It's like a mother figure.
Yeah.
And you're no newcomer to the theater. You've had a wide range of roles. Tell me about some of the others in the past.
Well, in the spring, I was Charlie in Willy Wonka.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, congratulations.
Thank you.
It's a great show.
That was really interesting. I had to convert from being Maisie in Seussical and all my girly dance moves there to being boyish Charlie in Willy Wonka. And that was definitely a good experience for me. I learned a lot from that learning experience.
Did you have to do did they have that bubble scene where you had to burp?
Yeah, that was gross.
Yeah.
for the first couple weeks I learned that, I couldn't do it because I kept laughing. And the guy who played my grandpa, he was really, really funny about it. And if you looked at him, you would have to start cracking up. So I could not make any eye contact the whole song.
I can understand that. Well, I know of all the roles out there, the highly coveted is that of Annie. And Sarah, tell me about Annie. I mean, what kind of gal is Annie?
She's really cheerful, and she's outgoing, and she's nice.
And the music? Really tough? Not so tough?
I know all of the songs, except one of them, all the tune already, because I've seen the movie a million times.
Yeah.
And I memorized Tomorrow already. The sun'll come out tomorrow. Bet your bottom dollar that tomorrow there'll be sun. Just thinking about tomorrow clears away the cobwebs and the sorrow till there's none. When I'm stuck with a day that's gray and lonely, I just stick out my chin and grin and say, oh, the sun'll come out tomorrow, so you gotta hang on till tomorrow. Come what may, tomorrow, tomorrow, I love you tomorrow, you're always a day away. Tomorrow, tomorrow, I love you tomorrow, you're always a day away.
That's pretty impressive, Sarah.
Thank you.
That's a first for WFDD. A cappella, in studio, no orchestra, and boy, good ears.
Thank you.
Nicole, share your experience in the theater a little bit. We were talking earlier about you got your friends in the theater, your friends' friends at school, kind of a different community.
Yes, it is. There's a difference because people who don't do theater are more laid back, and people who do theater just go all out.
A lot of my friends that don't do acting, they wonder, there's this party, why aren't you going? Well, I have play practice, I'd rather be there. And it's hard for them to understand because they've never done it, they've never had that passion for it. But I definitely love my theater friends, they're funny.
Aaron Diaz, director of not only Annie Jr., the owner of First in Flight Entertainment, welcome back to the studio.
It's always great to be here, thank you.
An amazing coalition of fantastic professional actors. Any difference in your approach? I mean, directing this group of young, talented young actors versus adults, and what is that approach?
Oh, it's going great. It's very different. I started getting into children's theater 2 years ago, and I absolutely love it because I get to meet kids that have never done shows before, and then there's some experienced kids that have been acting and singing since they were 3 and a half, as Sarah said earlier today. So it's pretty awesome. I started when I was 3 as well as a tap dancer, and it's really neat to be able to teach and direct and kind of pass on the torch. And then hopefully they'll be directing soon too.
your responsibility as director, you pair the actors with the roles that you know bring out the best in them. But you also, I imagine, you need to challenge them as well and give them something to grow into. How do you walk that line of keeping them comfortable and excelling, but also pushing them a little bit?
Oh, absolutely. In every show that we do, usually it's very rare if you'll play one character. Most of the time, kids will have to portray maybe a lead character in one scene, and then they'll also have other things. I always make it a mission to make sure that every single kid gets their moment, whether it's a solo line, whether it's a funny part in the show, whether it's a crazy costume they get to come out on, because I feel that when you do junior productions and when you do kids theater, it's so important for everyone to have that moment. Even if it's just 10 seconds of fame, they have that 10 seconds of fame. They're not just stuck in the background. My favorite part is after opening night, everyone rushes out and sees their family and their fans, and sometimes you're signing autographs to people they don't know and things like that. And you'll be surprised. I've had kids crying at auditions before. They've been so nervous, and people are like, oh, you're never going to get up on the stage. You're never going to do that. Well, they get in the show, they get up there, and pretty soon they're changing in all areas of their life. They're getting up and doing school presentations for the first time. They're getting a whole new group of friends. They're getting what they want in all aspects of life, whether it's sports or entertainment or whatever they want to do in life. So I think it's so important to give kids a great theater experience when they're young, because they can use that in whatever they do when they grow up, and it's pretty awesome.
Oh, Mr. Rabbit, wait, please.
And your next production is going to be Alice in Wonderland. You get a chance to dive right back into working with young actors. Boy, that's a great one. And when are auditions for that, and talk about your approach to that production?
Well, auditions are going to be September 1st on that, and that's going to be fantastic. It's all ages, so we're casting kids kindergarten through 12th grade, and we're choosing the top 20 kids that are going to audition for that show. It's not like a summer camp production. It's going to be actual an audition. And I am so excited about that show because there's so many fantastic characters. There's the Red Queen, and there's Alice, and there's the Mad Hatter, and the March Hare, and there's just so many characters, and what we can get from all those different characters. It's going to be a blast. So I hope we have some young auditioners that are listening right now.
All right. My thanks to Annie Jr., director, and First in Flight Entertainment owner Erin Diaz. She was joined in the studio by young actors Mary Sparr, who plays Lily St. Regis, Nicole Horton, who plays Kate, Celine Yalcin-Kaya, who plays Grace Farrell, and Sarah Rosenberg, who plays Annie. Annie Jr. There'll be three performances only, August 3rd at 7 and August 4th at 2 and 7 at the Southwest Elementary Auditorium, 1631 Southwest School Road in Clemens. And you'll find links to more information on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. You're listening to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford. Glad to be along with you today. On July 14th, the Governor's School of North Carolina celebrated its 50th anniversary. The Governor's School's remarkable program where each summer many of our state's best and brightest students gather for the pure love of learning and the joy of creativity. At the Governor's School, intellectual curiosity fuels the exploration of the latest ideas in a whole host of disciplines. One large component is the arts. This year, the drama group did a traditional 12th night performance one evening, changed gender roles, and performed it all over again the following afternoon. The Governor's School Orchestra performs only contemporary works by composers new to many at the school. This year's anniversary celebration almost never happened, though. Last year, state funding for the program was cut. Leading the drive to raise the $760,000 to restore the school was Wake Forest University Department of Education Professor Joseph Milner, and he joins me today, along with the man leading the charge to first establish the school 50 years ago. Renowned North Carolina author and special assistant to Governor Terry Sanford from 1962 to 64, John Ely. After signing up the Carnegie Corporation to fund half of the school for the first 3 years, Ely approached James A. Gray in Winston-Salem, who suggested the school be located in Salem, and a special meal to make it all happen.
So an appointment was made with John Gardner by the governor, and I went with him up there and sat absolutely silent while he talked to John Gardner about the school. and it was funded by the Carnegie Corporation for 3 years. And it was the governor's idea that if give the money to the Department of Public Instruction, let them run the governor's school for 3 years and put it on the state budget, although the money was provided. But then we had to raise the other half of the money. And he said, go talk to James A. Gray in Winston-Salem. And I did, and I told him we had sort of hoped to put the school in Raleigh, but we found that particular school had no available space in the summertime. So he said, well, Salem's over here. Come on, meet the people at Salem. And then he told me, if you've got to raise money, I tell the governor to call Henry Ram, who is in charge of gifts by the R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company, and tell him what the governor's school is, and ask him to host a luncheon of foundation and business executives and others in Winston-Salem and around. And at that luncheon, have Henry ask them for money, because he's been asked for money years, and he's never asked anybody for a cent. So the governor called Henry Ram and talked to him about the governor's school, and Henry Ram agreed to be the host of a luncheon of wealthy people and foundation executives to fund the rest of the governor's school for 3 years. Henry Ram asked the people if they wanted to participate in funding the governor's school, and there was quite a pause. And then one man spoke up and said, Henry, tell the governor we've got the money, and after lunch, let's divide it up. So that was it.
Boy. You look back on 50 years of the governor's school, John, what are you most proud of? What gives you the most satisfaction?
Well, it reminds me of Terry Sanford and what a remarkable governor he was. He sincerely wanted to use his office to be the best governor and the best servant of the state that he could. And he was an excellent mind. What an effective fellow he was. A great governor.
Joe, this is a huge milestone, 50 years of the governor's school, 50th anniversary, just celebrated last weekend.
Saturday night.
But it almost didn't come. Do you remember where you were when you first heard the news that the funding's been cut?
I don't remember where I was, but I do remember that my thought was, I've got to get to Raleigh immediately and talk to people that I know who worked in the appropriations area. And Lucy and I went and talked to Linda Juro, and she said no. She said, there's no talk about it. No one's interested.
What was your biggest regret when you got that news?
My thought was that the governor's school is a program for all the people of North Carolina. It's not a private school. It's not a very fancy place for people that have the wherewithal. It is a place where people from all over the state, from all income levels, from small towns and little towns and big towns, all come together and get to know each other and are changed, transformed. And so it was very difficult to accept the idea that the governor's school wouldn't be funded by the state and would have to be funded somehow by the group that I was a part of, the Governor's School Foundation. Faculty at Governor's School East and West, we actually did get the money together. In fact, it was up to $200,000. That was miracle one.
That was the press release I remember reading. We've reached the $200,000 milestone, which is incredible, in just a couple few months.
The greater part of the miracle was, and maybe it happened because, I left town. I went to England for 4 months. And I thought, the thing that has to happen when I leave is we have to find someone who really has a sense of how you do this job. And at that point, we looked at some people who were in the fundraising business, and David Winslow was chosen because partly he had been a governor's school person himself, and he was amazing.
So he came on board. What happened next?
They brought that money together, And that confirmed that Governor School would go forward. We went to the legislature with a lot of advocacy, tried to get their attention, talked to them, the leaders of the House and the Senate. And the miracle was that largely because of one senator who was ahead of appropriations, Stevens, he put us into the budget and carried us not only into the budget this year at $800,000, but into the recurring budget. And I think that's an amazing miracle.
That's Joseph Milner. He's a professor of education at Wake Forest University, and he also led the fight to refund the governor's school. He's happy to report that through a few more miracles, the state legislature recently agreed to fund the program through 2013. You're listening to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford. We're going to take a short break right now, but when we come back, I'll talk with a governor's school student about his experiences there and the director. Then on the second half of the show, it's Karoff at the keyboard. Our good friend Peter Karoff is just Chopin at the bit to tell us about his piano idol. And then it's on to a revealing Arts Council chat with Leon Porter. Do you know how many millions of dollars the arts brings to our local economy? I'll give you a clue. Guess higher. And Margaret Supplee Smith has some architectural gems she wants to share in our own backyard next when Triad Arts Up Close continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford. On July 14th, the Governor's School of North Carolina celebrated its 50th anniversary. It's a remarkable program where each summer many of our state's best and brightest students from a variety of socioeconomic backgrounds gather for the pure love of learning and the joy of creativity. At the Governor's School, intellectual curiosity fuels the exploration of the latest ideas on a whole host of issues. One of those is the arts. My guest today, 2012 Governor's School percussion student Alex Kim, says the orchestra's focus was on contemporary works. We'll be sampling from their performance today, but this year's anniversary celebration almost never happened. Last year, state funding for the Governor's School program was cut. The North Carolina legislature recently approved funding for 2013. Today in the program, North Carolina Governor's School Director Lucy Milner joins me. Lucy, as director of the Governor's School, what are the common misconceptions about Governor's School?
I think that there has been a sense of its being an elite school, that the brightest kids in the state are going to get it on their own. Why devote these resources when you've got things like Smart Start and Head Start, who so badly needed funding? But there is a more worrisome sense among some in the state that we're a school that has an agenda, that we try to indoctrinate students in new ways of thinking that divide them from their home values, their home beliefs and opinions. We are so much not that, but nevertheless, I think it's that view that we are a dangerous left-leaning place that has been one of the things that I think caused legislatures to hesitate to continue to fund us.
And Alex?
That's absolutely right. I had heard the same thing from people where I live, that it was this left-leaning community and that the whole goal was indoctrination. And I just wanted to say from my perspective that that's certainly not true. There's actually a huge emphasis on sharing your own opinions and discussing them with others in an open and non-biased format. And it was actually surprising to me because I'd heard so much negative talk about that there was a bias. And it was very, very nice to see that there wasn't towards any side of the political spectrum. And there's such a loving attitude by the faculty towards encouraging the students here to see all the sides of an issue, not just one particular side.
In your case, we're talking about a percussionist. You were involved in the artistic core of the program. Talk me through a day in the life, Alex, at Governor's School.
We at Governor's School don't just focus on your primary discipline, which would be what we call your Area 1, which would be, for me, music. They break it up into three different classes, you could say. There's your Area 1, which is your main one, then Area 2 and Area 3. And during a typical day, you'll have two out of these three. And the way the Area 2 and Area 3 work are that it's a classroom mix of students from other disciplines. And you're encouraged in Area 2 to discuss philosophical questions such as where does morality come from, what is real, or what is the truth, and they're very high level intellectual discussions that cross the boundaries of all the disciplines. And then in Area 3, you are encouraged to discuss your own opinions towards different matters, both controversial and non-controversial. And through those three disciplines, it's an amazing way to think about new ideas that are not just limited towards your area of expertise as far as what you're studying here. So I'm not just doing music the whole day. I'm also talking about my opinions on drug laws in this country or on marriage laws. And then I'm talking about moral questions. It's wonderful that the Governor's School isn't just focused on doing one thing, math or science. It's focused on developing you as a well-rounded person.
As a percussionist, in terms of that discipline, are you paired with a private teacher, or do you do master class format, or how do you learn music?
Ah, this is another very interesting thing about Governor's School, is that it's not all rehearsals. We do have a percussion instructor. There's a woodwind instructor, low strings instructor, upper strings, brass. Though we do have sectionals, that they call them, where we work just with our instruments and with this this instructor, Nick, in my case, for percussion, which we can have private lessons with. We also have two other classes that deal with music. We have context classes and improvisation classes. So the context classes basically put the pieces we're playing into their historical context, and that one's pretty straightforward. The improv classes are not quite so straightforward as far as what you're used to. I remember when I went in there the first day, I was expecting to do some jazz improvisation or something that I was used to. And the way it works here at Governor's School is you're encouraged, or you do. You play your instrument in a way you never have before. You you play on the wrong parts of your instrument. If you're a string player, you'll play with the wood part of your bow, I don't even know the terminology, on the bridge of the instrument, and making all sorts of crazy sounds. Actually, because I thought that I might talk about this, I brought one instrument that I was playing in one of our improv classes, which is a metal water bottle with a brass mallet. And if you hit it, you can get this. I'll play that again for you. You can get a very unique sound, and it really, actually, it's an amazing part of your musical education. I love to compose, for instance, music, and there's so many new sounds I've heard from all these instruments in the room, because we're mixed up with people that play different instruments in these improv classes, and I've been exposed to so many sounds I didn't think these instruments could make, and you can incorporate them into future works, and it's an amazing way to get to know your instrument in a way you never have before.
I was curious to know what your take was on this, on the emphasis on contemporary music.
Oh yeah, that's something that a lot of students in the first week were just really griping about, you know, because we're all used to playing the same things in our home orchestras, Tchaikovsky, Rimsky-Korsakov, but when we got here, we're playing works by Penderecki and Schoenberg, who are two, I guess you could say, new music composers. They compose using alternative styles of composing, not the typical melodic systems we're used to. They use 12-tone systems and mathematical and intervallic ways of writing music that are very, one could say, dissonant, but not always. It's so different that we often perceive it right off the bat as negative. But once you listen to it for a while, you realize that it really is a beautiful work of art.
Yeah, that's great. And what an opportunity, because like you said, there are not going to be too many band arrangements of Penderecki. You're not going to hear Clarinet and Oct for a marching band anytime soon.
Well, you know, I want to say this about what Alex has just described. The orchestra performs throughout the session, and their concerts are required for everyone. So that just as Alex had the shock of the new in his first week, so too do all of the non-musical students listening. And that shock leads us into the very kind of speculative discussions that Alex was describing. And that's what takes place in this Area 2 and Area 3 class, so that we all experience it together and it becomes like a open textbook for the rest of us. And I think that that is what Terry Sanford might have hoped, that this school could open students to things they would never have heard in their home schools or on their radios, and that that then would prepare them to be leaders themselves in whatever field, because they had been opened to an alternative way of hearing and seeing and thinking.
We kind of got a hint at it from Alex. I appreciate you sharing how this sort of discipline and this approach to education has impacted your life. Are there any commonalities in how the Governor's School experience impacts young lives in terms of their experience? What are you hearing, Lucy, when, say, alumni come back and talk to you about how important the school was to them?
Two adjectives that are commonly used to describe the experience by returning alumni are life-changing or life-altering. So many say that their trajectories in life have been slightly altered by this very short 6 weeks, and in this case, sadly, 5 week session, because they return different. They are able to comprehend, to tolerate ambiguity, to embrace the new in ways that they haven't before.
My thanks to Governor's School of North Carolina Director Lucy Milner and 2012 percussion student Alex Kim. The North Carolina Legislature recently approved funding for 2013. This is Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford, and we're going to take another short break. When we return, it's Understanding Classical Music with Kiroff at the keyboard and that master pianist-composer Frédéric Chopin. Then we get up close and personal with the Arts Council of Winston-Salem and Forsyth County with Mr. Leon Porter. He's 75% of the way there on the big fundraising campaign, and it's up to you to do the rest. And we'll wrap up today with a leisurely architectural stroll through the last century and the triad work of Renola House architect Charles Barton Keene. Next, when Triad Arts Up Close continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford, and this is our good friend, pianist, and Wake Forest University professor of music, Mr. Peter Kiroff, Understanding Classical Music.
A major composer who confined almost everything he wrote to the piano, Frédéric Chopin. You know, if you think of all the other great composers, Beethoven and Bach and Mozart, they wrote in all sorts of styles. They wrote symphonies and vocal music and on and on. And Chopin almost completely wrote for the piano. He wrote a few pieces for piano and singers, piano and cello and so on. But really, the heart and soul of Chopin's music is at the keyboard. He's sometimes called the poet of the piano, because his music seems to speak to us in a way that takes music to a more profound and almost a literary level. It makes you want to say, what's it about? You know, what's he trying to say? Well, Chopin's music is not just dreamy. There are plenty of pieces like that in this kind of gentle and dreamy style, but quite a few of them where he just tears up the keyboard. He was, after all, a real virtuoso. You know that word, a virtuoso, someone who was just an incredible performer. There were piano virtuosos traveling all through the world, the kind of rock stars of their day, really. People would swoon at their concerts and just be astonished not only at the beauty of their music, but at the facility, at their instrument, whether it was the piano or the violin or even singers. I think really the core to understanding Chopin's music, however, might seem ironic, is is not really the piano at all, but it's rather the human voice. You know, Chopin told his students, if you really want to know how to play the piano well, listen to great singers. And so much of Chopin's music is inspired by the kinds of arias that he was hearing in Italian bel canto operas in the first half of the 19th century. There, your right hand is the soprano. Your left hand is a simple orchestral accompaniment. And the singer can then float above it. Well, the tradition of these Italian opera singers in the 1820s and 30s and 40s was to not simply sing their melodies straight, but rather to ornament and to embellish and to add. And Chopin does that sort of thing all the time. So the simple melody becomes embellished with these extra moving lines. Sometimes it's embellished like an opera singer, by adding florid melodic additions. So the simple becomes, we think of that style as Chopin-esque, but actually Chopin himself would have thought of that as operatic. Chopin's also famous for writing a set of pieces that basically show what he can do at the piano and what future generations of pianists can strive to achieve. These pieces are called etudes. An etude in French is simply a practice piece, a study piece. Just something to strengthen the fingers. But in Chopin's hands, these etudes become something transcendent. Now, let's say you have an issue and you want to write a piece with a fast right hand and nothing much going on in the left hand. Well, there's an etude for that. If you want a fast left hand, you want to work on your left hand agility, there's an etude for that. The great thing about Chopin etudes is that they're not just piano music, they're just great music. And that's the thing about Chopin in general. His music moves the soul. It never feels confined to the realm of simply being, quote-unquote, just piano music. It's music that speaks to the ages. Frédéric Chopin.
What a musical journey, and all for the low, low tuition cost of absolutely nothing. That was pianist extraordinaire and Wake Forest University professor of music, Mr. Peter Karoff. This is Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford, and now it's time for a tribute to the arts in our own community and one organization that's been doing more than just about any other to raise the bar and keep it up there. The Arts Council of Winston-Salem and Forsyth County was the first locally established arts council in the country way back in 1949. Today, there are more than 4,000 arts councils in the U.S., and they're enriching the lives of millions of people. The Arts Council of Winston-Salem and Forsyth County impacts those communities as well as neighboring ones by raising funds for the arts, advocating for artists, and sponsoring events in conjunction with other arts organizations. The council also provides lots of educational opportunities for students, doing its part to fill the gaps left behind from huge cuts in arts education funding throughout the region. They've played a big role in spurring economic development here as well. The Triad's thriving arts scene makes the City of Arts and Innovation an attractive destination for job recruitment and retention. By strengthening our cultural resources, the Arts Council generates hundreds of full-time jobs and millions of dollars in tax revenue. The primary source of funding comes through the Arts Council United Annual Arts Campaign, which wraps up in September. Winston-Salem attorney and chair of the Arts Campaign, Leon Porter, recently took a break from fundraising to chat with me about it. Tell us what the Arts Council traditionally does in this community for this Forsyth County area.
The Arts Council in this community is first and foremost a united fund for arts groups. There are currently 22 funded members of the Arts Council. They range from everything as large as Rinalda House to the Symphony to Piedmont Opera, National Black Theater Festival, River Run Film Festival, but smaller groups as well, like the Kernersville Little Theater and the Piedmont Chamber Singers. And it also helps sponsor and put on a number of festivals, educational events in the schools, and things like that.
Okay. Having the funds on hand to distribute to the various organizations and to run these education programs, a big part of that is the United Annual Arts Campaign, of which you are chair. And wanting to know, what are your primary responsibilities heading this group?
Our responsibility this year is to raise $2.35 million. That, along with some other funds like a small endowment, help create the entire budget for the Arts Council for the year, most of which is given away to arts organizations and artists in the region and educational events.
We're well into this season of giving for the Arts Council. How's the campaign going?
The campaign is going well. We've made excellent progress we've crossed the 75% towards goal. We now have until the end of September, though, to finish the campaign. Often the last 25% is some of the most difficult portion to get. Winston-Salem Forsyth County is the area for the Arts Council, but it reaches outside of the county into surrounding counties, most all surrounding counties, and a number of our gifts do come from those other counties as well. We particularly make grants to individual artists throughout the region in all fields, dance, painting, music, and other fields beyond Winston-Salem and Forsyth County.
As a local NPR affiliate employee, as a person well acquainted with this, the concept of fund drives and pledge drives here at the station, we notice a phenomenon where people tend to pledge the last day of the drive. Is there any parallel between this sort of giving and what we experience here at the station?
It is true there are a lot of pledges at the end, a lot the last month. It's not so much the last day, but it's the last few weeks where a number of pledges come in. And sometimes organizations and people hear how close we are to the goal, and they jump in to help us get there.
Okay. But obviously we can't count on that.
That's correct. It's really beneficial now to have as many of the pledges in as we can. The Arts Council grant panels are at the task now of making decisions on awarding the grants for the next year, the grants that will be funded by this campaign. So the more we know about the amount of pledges are that we're going to receive, the more that those grant panels can determine exactly what the grants would be for next year.
A recent study you all put out spoke to some very specific areas in this economy and the drivers behind it, the arts in a lot of cases. Which of those stats really jumped out at you, Leon, as something that really is spectacular?
The ones that jumped out at me are in this study that was done statewide, and then we looked at the Forsyth County portion, that the nonprofit arts put $136 million into the local economy. It supports 4,769 full-time equivalent jobs, and a striking number is that it generates more than $13.7 million in tax revenue here.
I was so glad to see this comprehensive study come out, because you can talk and talk and talk about being the city of arts and innovation, but when you see those numbers, you realize it's integral to the success and the viability of this community.
It is, and one thing we found even more this year in going to some of the medium-sized companies in Winston-Salem, many you've seen in the paper recently and other reports, have been growing, adding jobs. When we speak with them, they tell us how much what the Arts Council does adds to their efforts to recruit and retain new employees in Winston-Salem. Programs sponsored and supported by the Arts Council actually reach all of the elementary schools in the county, the high schools, and some of the middle schools 3 to 4 times a year with programs, with artists coming in, particularly symphony music. the Winston-Salem Symphonies will send a smaller group to schools to do a performance, and they interact with the students while they're there as well, talk about their instruments, how they learned. Students begin talking about instruments that they play.
My thanks to the Arts Council of Winston-Salem and Forsyth County United Annual Arts Campaign Chair, Leon Porter. The Arts Council, our country's very first, has been doing its part to keep the Piedmont Triad art scene alive and well since 1949. Have you been doing yours? If you take advantage of the arts in your community, don't take the arts for granted. Thankfully, it's not too late to help support the council that makes it all happen. The Arts Council United Annual Arts Campaign doesn't wrap up until September, and you'll find out how you can support the arts on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. You're listening to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford. From the main line to Tobacco Road, the architecture of Charles Barton Keene. That's the talk being given by Wake Forest University Harold W. Tribble Professor of Art Emerita Margaret Supley Smith. It's this Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock at the Rinalda House Museum of American Art. Beginning in the 1920s, Keene designed 25 homes in Winston-Salem. While Rinalda House tops that list, you can find four more magnificent examples on Stratford Road, just a stone's throw from Five Points. Margaret's fascination with Keene goes way back. What kind of man was Charles Barton Keene?
He was a very successful architect in the Northeast and on the main line, which was the center of country house design in the early 20th century. He evidently was so personable and amiable that all of his clients really liked him. I think he's what we would call a superb journeyman architect, in that he had an incredibly high standard of design and just sort of an arsenal of styles that he could work with. And the period in which he worked was known as an eclectic period in architecture. So he could pull up Georgian Revival, Bungalow, Tudor Revival, and every house is really beautifully done. In a way, that's what's so astonishing about Winston-Salem, that midway through his career, he came here. He was hired by a Reynolds relative, but then it was really Catherine Smith Reynolds who was his major patron. Mm-hmm. And he ended up designing about 25 buildings in Winston-Salem. So he's not innovative in the way that we think of Frank Lloyd Wright, but he definitely was an extremely fine designer. And I think he actually was influenced by Wright in a little bit, in the way that Wright also was part of the arts and crafts movement. And both Keene and Wright come out of arts and crafts, and Keene moves into the bungalow and then eventually Georgian Revival. Wright moves into the Prairie Style. Winston-Salem enjoyed astonishing prosperity in the 1920s. And that's because we had R.J. Reynolds, Haynes Hosiery, Chatham Blankets, the Wachovia Bank was going great guns. R.J. Reynolds had set up its stock options to remain local rather than going around the world and sharing the wealth. What that meant is there was wealth concentrated in this city, the small southern city.
Which happened to be the biggest in the state.
Winston always was competitive with Greensboro, Charlotte, and Raleigh. And for a brief moment in 1920, it was the largest city in North Carolina, and it was also, I think, probably the wealthiest. So what you have is Charles Barton Keene coming from Philadelphia, having already designed for very elite clients there, and designing for Catherine Smith Reynolds, a really wonderful design. Rinalda is probably the best of all the bungalows that he designed.
This is one of those buildings I've always loved from the moment I laid eyes on it, without the architectural background. Talk about some of those elements that strike you as the art historian that really are unique.
As you drive up the road and the house suddenly appears, disappears, and then it's very, very comfortable in its setting. I think the fact that it's a bungalow, and you know the classic definition of a bungalow is a two-story house that's designed to look like it's only one story. So what you really see is that expansive porch with those heavy columns, and then the green roof with Ludovici tile. And that green Ludovici tile is one of the brands associated with Charles Barton Keene. And I have to add that Ludovici tile is going to be one of the sponsors of this article. Everyone loves Ludovici tile. So what you have is this very clean look. Historically, we can look at Rinalda and see, oh, it's healthy moving out in the country. It's the sanitary movement. They don't have a lot of ornament and decoration. But the proportions are absolutely superb.
Tied into that, and this is from a conversation with one of the guests speaking with Robin Carson about the landscape design and how so much of what you see with these great buildings is tied into the landscape architecture, which we also can take for granted. But the setting is so important, and it's the two in tandem, I think, work so beautifully with Rinalda House.
Well, one of the really interesting things about Charles Barton Keene is, one, you know, he went to architecture school in Pennsylvania. His cousin was one of the three founders of House and Garden magazine. And the first issue, 1901, of House and Garden magazine is a bungalow in Bryn Mawr. It still is there today, by Charles Barton Keene. And the whole point of that design is a house that is crafted, but it extends into the landscape with a pergola, and then the gardens go down behind it. So really, it's house and garden as one design. And Rinalda works that way, too.
Yeah. Fascinating time and place, and the result being some of these gorgeous homes, and we're surrounded with them here in Winston-Salem on Stratford Road and Rinalda Park. I want to talk about some specific ones with you, too. But what was the initial draw? What drew you to Charles Barton Keene initially?
Well, this goes back a really long time. I moved here from Boston in 1979, and Rinalda was the American Art Museum in Winston-Salem. And in the early 80s, Barbara Milhouse and Nick Bragg decided that they wanted to actually focus on that. And so I worked on an exhibit for Rinalda House. And so I looked at it as a country house. And I think that in Winston-Salem, because it had been so linked to the R.J. Reynolds family, that people hadn't stopped to think how astonishing it was that we had this huge country estate, beautifully designed, graceful materials, and that it really started that country house era in Winston-Salem. 3 years ago, I was doing research on Charles Barton Keene outside of Philadelphia. And let me just say that everybody who owns a Charles Barton Keene house loves it.
Why? What specifically about those homes do they most take pride in?
I think that they are beautifully designed, that they work for a family living inside of it. They're unpretentious, but you still know you're looking at architecture. Hmm. One of the really interesting things that I've found in my research, the Reynolds kin, who hired Charles Barton Keene, all designed bungalows. White stucco, it's going to have green Ludovici tile on the roof. Houses for the Haynes family, for instance, or for the Chathams, are Georgian Revival houses. They're built of brick. They have dark slate roofs. A great example is on Stratford Road. As soon as you leave the commercial area at Five Points, there are five wonderful houses, large rectangular houses, uniform setback.
I know them well. And we should let listeners know, by large, we're talking 10 bedrooms in some cases. I mean, they're very large.
Right. And the way you say it in architectural history, not a five-bay house, but a seven-bay. Each one is a different material. There's a gray stucco. There's a brick. There's a red brick. There's brown brick. There's a Tudor Revival. There's an Italianate feeling. There's a Georgian Revival. So within a template of this country house, there's then variation on the architectural style. And that's something that comes in later, and it comes in more for Haynes and Chathams.
Were those Keynes?
They're Keynes. They're all Keynes. They're all by Charles Barton Keene.
That's really remarkable for me because I pass them all the time, and I've wondered, you know, there's a similarity, but they're unique in their own right.
That's right. One other thing I would say in connection to those four houses, on Georgia is another large house, one of the largest that Charles Barton Keene designed in Winston-Salem that was built for P.H. Haynes. And then on First Street, there was another Haynes house, and that one was designed by Northrop and O'Brien. And I think that when Keene came to Winston-Salem in 1912, designed Rinalda, then came back in 1923 and designed a group of houses, he raised the game of every architect in town. So every fine house is not a Charles Barton Keene house, but there is a level of excellence that they have. I think that's one of the wonderful things about architecture is that you have a house that's built at a particular period of time for a particular reason, and that house just keeps on living through the years, used by different families, friends, changing neighborhoods, but it sort of encapsulates a history over time.
My thanks to Wake Forest University Harold W. Tribble Professor of Art Emerita Margaret Suplee Smith. Her talk, From the Main Line to Tobacco Road, The Architecture of Charles Barton Keene, is this Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock at the Rinalda House Museum of American Art. Well, that's all for today's program. Our senior producer is Catherine Mobley, and our audio engineer is Eddie Garcia. You'll find links to more information about all of the arts organizations and events we've covered today on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. And as always, I'd love to hear from you. Please send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for joining me today for Triad Arts Up Close.